Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
Aliens, you shall be punished. You, Captain Kirk, yours shall be the pattern of your death.
I'm not Ike Clanton.
Well, I'm glad to meet you, Mr. Kirk.
You've got until 5 tonight to get your horse-stealing, scurvy crew out of town.
The Earps will kill the Clantons at the OK Corral at 5 o'clock.
We are the Clantons.
At 1 minute past 5, you'll find a hole in your head right from this gun.
Billy! We're not going to move from this spot.
So, by my calculations, it's 142 years since the official gunfight at the OK Corral, which, of course, is at the center point of this latest edition of Resonance Rewind. Of course, Spectre of the Gun, directed by Vincent McAvity, of course, and written by Gene Coon, amongst others from that point of view, with music by Jerry Fielding. Let's jump straight to Victoria Simmons. Victoria, your thoughts on this Western experience for the crew of the Starship Enterprise original series?
Unbelievable. Unexciting. I just didn't get on with it at all.
Okay. That's
I'm
fine.
Sorry to all those Star Trek fans, but it was just so dull.
Okay, well, we're going to try and address some of those key aspects within this. Ian Barnsley, somebody who probably wasn't around when the first series originally aired, but certainly is one of the earlier generations of Trek followers. What are your thoughts on the battle with the Malkotians, in which, obviously, we are disease? We are should be cast out. Sentence has been pronounced, and it will now be carried out.
I quite enjoyed it. I mean, it probably is one of the first uses of the Western genre in Star Trek, but it certainly wasn't to be the last. I mean, almost every series had some visit to the Wild West at some point or another. I did enjoy it. Although it's not probably the most ideal way to learn about the gunfight at the OK Corral, it did give me a bit of education into the history of the Wild West a little bit. I wasn't too pleased about the cheapness of it and the fact that it was just the front of all the buildings in the town and none of the back. But I mean, I think the explanation was that they'd run out of money and they didn't have a lot of money to pay for sets. But also, they tried to explain it off as that they only managed to see a little bit of the minds of the Star Trek characters to be able to do a certain amount in terms of the set itself. So it looked a bit cheap, as even for that Star Trek standards to me.
I mean, certainly the minimalist approach which was taken was, as you rightly say, I think, down to the cost savings. But at the same time, given the whole dream atmosphere of the whole experience, I think it kind of worked. And I must admit, it's grown on me over the years. Jessica Burtis, your first time around, I suspect, for this third season original series episode of Star Trek, of course, Spectre of the Gun, part of the American mythology writ large. What are your thoughts?
I really liked it. And I watched part with my dad because he remembered like part of him. He remembered something about the Wild West from when he was a little kid watching it. And I think the Wild West was such an interesting setting for it, because the comparison of the two frontiers of space and the Wild West was very interesting. And I actually did like the bare bones set because it definitely made it feel very alien, and it made it feel very unreal and very liminal. I like the background, but how they chose like that like red color. It definitely made it feel a little bit threatening and ominous. So I think that that was well done, and I liked the it was just fun seeing, you know, the Enterprise crew all wearing their colorful uniforms with little Old West belts with the little six shooters on. It was very, very interesting to see all of like the ways that they change certain things. So I really like this.
There were a
One of my
whole range
favorites that
of,
we've watched. I mean, sorry.
I mean, again, there were a whole range of aspects that come across within the actual series. From, of course, the way in which the encounter with the Melkots is first developed, and that immediate use of Kirk as his mind, his memory of the early pioneers of the American USA, effectively being used to kind of serve as the means of their destruction, and of course the ultimate sort of line that we see in terms of Spock using the mind melds to effectively prove that actually it is all an illusion. It's almost as though you take another meta narrative step back to that sense that it is actually completely illusion, and so we're left with this sense that actually they hadn't even crossed the borderline that the Melkots had actually put up in the first place, because they kind of were back on the Enterprise without ever having really left the Enterprise. And I think the way they played with the mind with that was quite effective. Interesting fun fact, Jessica, the music for this was written by Jerry Fielding, who also composed the music for The Trouble with Tribbles. So I thought you'd sort of appreciate that, and certainly the very bizarre, almost psychotic playing of Buffalo Gals, which most of us were familiar with through the classic James Stewart movie It's a Wonderful Life, I think kind of really works in terms of when they go into the Western canteen or the bar, etc., and the saloon, I should say. And it's obviously it's disconnected, it's disharmonious, it's problematic. Ian, what about your favorite moments of this particular episode? Any thoughts for Bonnie Beecher's character of Sylvie, of course, who many people say inspired Bob Dylan to write Girl from the North Country, the actress Bonnie Beecher, that is.
I think my favourite moments all involved Chekhov, really. I think he provided the comedy value in the episode, and just the look on his face, because he got the love interest instead of Kirk, as Kirk normally gets the kisses and gets the girls. This time it was Chekhov, and you could tell he was really, really getting into that.
It was, I believe, Walter Koenig's favorite episode as Chekhov. He certainly tends to cite this when asked about his sequence from that point of view. There was, of course, a nice little undercurrent about of racism that we saw with respect to Spock being accused of being inhuman, whilst, of course, Scott and Spock forgot that effectively he was half human from that point of view. And again, I think that was an interesting line, which sort of showed the notion of tolerance. For the whole system. Something which, again, the episode tends to end on, insofar as how did humanity manage to survive? The question that Spock puts to Kirk, and the somewhat trite answer, which many people living in the 21st century would say we overcame our instinct for violence, still suggests we've got a long way to go. Victoria, you're shaking your head on that one. I mean, again, you've been quite clear so far about the sort of sequence. Did you have any favorite moments for yourself which stood out? Or was it a case of you just felt it was too unbelievable?
No, I agree with Ian about the love interest not being Kirk. That was nice. But I quite like when Kirk asks the barman, "What do you see?" And he's coming out, "Well, what are you talking about? I see this person. I see you wearing this. No, I don't feel a different texture in your clothes." And it kind of reminded me about being actors. And who do you see when you look at me? Well, when I'm playing this character, you see me as this, but do you see me as me? No, you don't. So.
Yeah, see, do these clothes look like yours? Not exactly. Have you ever seen clothes like this before? Sure, where? On the Clamptons. You clowns are always great with your jokes. That's why we laugh. We like you. I mean, again, it's interesting in terms of the revisionist notion of history here that the Earps, of course, were portrayed very much as the villains, whereas I think most Western mythology would see Wyatt Earp and Morgan Earp and Doc Holliday, of course, with his offer of teeth pulling by appointment as being at the heart of quality stuff. I mean, Jessica, again, from the Western point of view, given that Star Trek was originally sold by Gene Roddenberry as Wagon Train to the Stars, this is a very explicit use of the Western scenario. What were your favorite moments?
I mean, I think that I just love like Old West settings because I think it's such an iconic period of time and place. And I think that the, you know, shootouts in the saloon, the cowboys, like that's so iconic. And I think it's always fun. I see why a lot of shows have an episode that is centered around the Old West. So I think I actually had a lot of favorite points of this episode. I think one of my favorites was when the Melkotians, Melkotians, they were speaking to them in their head with telepathy, and everyone was saying like, oh, it's Vulcan, no, it's English, no, it's Russian, no, it's Swahili, and they were all like, oh, it's telepathy. I thought that was really clever how it was speaking to them all in the language that they thought in. I thought that was really cool that they did that. And I think also just also as both of them have pointed out, Chekhov having the love interest instead of Spock, because when the girl first ran over, I thought, I mean, not Spock, instead of Kirk, because when she over, I was like, oh, she's about to go hug Kirk. But then she went to Chekhov and I was like, oh my goodness, it's different for the first time. and also, of course, then at the end when it's kind of revealed that they were spared for, you know, choosing like peace. He kind of broke this pattern of death. So I thought that was a really poetic ending.
Hmm. Let's move on slowly but surely to favorite characters. Ian, who stood out for yourself as characters that you thought were particularly memorable from this particular episode?
I originally talked about Chekhov earlier, but I would like to know, although he didn't have an awful lot to do, Bones, DeForest Kelly's character, was ironic, seeing as he'd already been in the original film, The Gunfight at the OK Corral, as in the image behind my head at the moment. Mm. I think it was his involvement in it was particularly poignant, I think.
Yeah, and of course the frustration where effectively he can't quite believe that everything that he put into the gas canister just didn't work, that it should have worked. Everything was measured out. He did it all appropriately. He connected all that. And yet that leads to the clue that Spock realizes that, you know, the laws of science, the laws of physics in a reality obviously take precedence. And here, clearly, the thing wasn't the case. The kind of second stage after, of course, Billy Claiborne's character had been killed, or Chekhov's character as Billy Claiborne, which, of course, was against the original line as far as he survived the original battle of the OK Corral. So again, that notion that something was not quite right with the whole thing, and the sense that really would be echoed by the Wachowskis in The Matrix, where whenever we see these glitches in reality, it's a signifier that maybe something is a little bit unusual and offbeat from that point of view. Victoria, you addressed some of the key things at the start about the things you didn't like about the episode. Can you, I mean, let's turn that on its head. Were those things not part of the reason why, as you heard from Jessica and Ian, they actually were really strong parts of the episode, that it did actually use a minimalist approach, that it did actually present the viewer with a challenge, that, you know, you're left thinking, well, you know, it was a very trite line that the only thing that was real to Chekhov was the girl who was, she was so real, Captain, as he says. And yet that's kind of flipped on its head in terms of how they got back to the Enterprise and how, you know, what were they doing there? Were they in a state of suspended animation? Were they in a trance? What was happening to the rest of the crew, etc.?
Story-wise, okay, maybe it sort of lifted a little bit with the arguments, but acting-wise, no. You can't change how they've said something. Yeah, and it was just sort of, I don't know, I just was bored when I was watching it. It didn't, when something went wrong, they didn't seem as though they were concerned. It was all very flat.
Hmm. Okay.
The only person that seemed to have any kind of life was the woman.
Sylvia.
Yeah. She was the only one that actually seemed to be playing, like, have life in her. That everybody else was really sort of flat. And I suppose maybe because she was so great that, yeah, everybody else fell even flatter.
Okay. I mean, Ron
I
Sobel.
I know, it's sad.
It's an opinion, and everybody is entitled to an opinion. Ron Sobel, who played Wyatt Earp, also commented that part of the direction from Vincent McAvity was, again, very much given to this line of the sense of dreamlike unreality. And I suppose to a certain extent, there is that sense when we do dream, although we have on the one hand control over the perceptions we're actually seeing, scenes do fade in and out of each other. The inner logic doesn't really make sense on that side of things there. We saw in terms of what really got Koenig's Chekhov character irate was when he actually said, "Mr. Earp, get your hands off her." And then obviously he went for the gun and obviously ended up in his death in this particular sequence. I mean, Jessica, how did you find the acting and the delivery? Because again, I feel that, you know, the ultimate sequence, of course, which was Spock using the mind melds to convince his compadres, Kirk, McCoy and Scotty, that effectively the bullets were unreal, that they did not exist, that they were quite literally, to quote the title of the show, spectres with shadows without substance, spectres of the gun.
I liked it. I think, and I haven't seen a ton of Star Trek episodes, so I'm not super familiar with every actor's like the way that they always portray their characters, but I think from what I've seen, I liked the acting in this, and I think we also the other characters, like the Erbsen, Doc Holliday, and some new people. So it was interesting seeing how familiar I had gotten with the acting of the Enterprise crew, because there were others in there, and that I really do see them in this episode as their characters and not just as their actors. Like watching Spock acting, I wasn't thinking about his actor. I was thinking just about Spock. So I don't thought that they did well. But I will say that it's not my favorite episode, of course, because that would be the Tribbles. I think that one was just so fun. And I love the chaos and the acting in that one. But I still think that this one was, I think that they did a good job.
Mm. Ian, your thoughts on the acting and the delivery, or is it a case of, you know, do you go somewhere between Victoria and Jessica, or do you take one side or the other?
I think as regards the heroes, the acting amongst the normal cast wasn't very great, apart from Chekhov, actually. But I would say that there was a couple of, I think the bartender, when speaking to Kirk, I think he was quite, you know, his character was quite a good character, just as much as Chekhov's love interest.
Yeah, Charles.
I did also enjoy Spock and Bones going all MacGyver, fashioning a gas grenade out of almost absolutely nothing. It just made me think of MacGyver.
The classic line: all those Western Cossacks had were poisonous snakes and cactus plants. And it was an interesting thing. Probably might even say the A-Team would also borrow a similar sense of ingenuity in latter years as well from that point of view. We haven't actually heard anything for Ed McCready, of course, who played the barber, who I think when he was giving Doc Holliday the haircut and so on, or the shave, I felt he kind of, again, adept. And again, one of my own personal favourites, the actual voice of the Melkoshian, who we actually heard on a previous Resonance Rewind, Demon with the Glass Hand, an episode of The Outer Limits, Abraham Sophia. I did feel that the voice of the Melkoshian again kind of carried with it its appropriate level of threat and sonorousness, etc. Although, again, you could argue that although they kind of felt that mankind was diseased and needed to be cast out and so on, that actually realizing that maybe we weren't all that bad, again, the question, is this the way of your kind, was a little bit of a kind of easy wrap up to the whole sequence. Any thoughts on the Earps, of course, Morgan Earp played by Rex Holman, or Charles Maxwell played by Virgil Earp, etc.? Again, they did seem to be very robotic in terms of their approach, but at the same time, relentless in their pursuit of what they saw as the right thing to do. Jessica, thoughts from yourself?
Thank you.
don't have much time.
Captain, I vaguely remember the historical account of the famous battle in which we are about to engage, but I am confused.
About what?
Since each of us represents members of the Clanton gang, you, Ike Clanton, I, Frank McLowry, then Mr. Chekhov would be the other Billy, would he not?
William Claiborne, that's right.
But did not William Claiborne survive the battle at the OK Corral?
Get to the point, Spock.
Mr. Chekhov is dead, but in the actual gunfight, William Claiborne survived.
Yes. Yes, that's right. That means it doesn't have to happen the way it happened. We can change it. Bones, how's the tranquilizer coming?
I'll have it ready before Spock.
Spock?
Another hour.
And we'll have a tranquilizer grenade?
Not precisely.
Forget precision. Will it work?
It should.
Make sure it does, Spock. If we don't tranquilize them, we'll have to fight them.
And if we fight them, we all die. We know that.
Negotiating with them could buy us more time, Captain.
But not with the Earps. I've tried that. That's out. There must be a way. History has been changed in the fact that Billy Claiborne didn't die, but Chekhov is lying there dead. That means there must be a way to change this time in history.
It would be worth a try, at least until we're certain of the device. Then perhaps we could quiet things down.
But not with the Earps. There is one other place I can try.
You looking for somebody?
Yes, Sheriff. I want you to stop the fight.
Stop it? Who wants to stop it? I sure don't. You don't. You didn't yesterday.
I do now.
Since when does a Clanton run crawling to the law for help?
How else is he going to get justice?
From this. You and your boys set up this whole thing to take care of the Earps. It's a little late to decide you don't have the belly for it.
It's not too late.
Sheriff.
Sheriff. There must be plenty of decent people in this town who don't like the Earps. Let's organize.
Don't talk nonsense. The people in this town are counting on you to get rid of the Earps for them.
And the people better wake up and let the law work for them.
You can talk that way after what the Earps did to Billy today. Nobody in this town will deny you your right to your revenge.
Yes, I want revenge. I want to crush the life out of the Earps. Just kill them.
If you listen to me, get down to the OK Corral. Keep out of sight. When the Earps come looking, you bushwhack them.
Can I get through your stomach? Can I get just kill them?
It's the only way.
I can't just kill them.
It's the only
way. I can't murder them. I can't kill them.
Kill them any way you can. There'll be no questions asked. Honest. I guarantee that.
These crude supplies we were forced to use worked quite well.
I doubt that this combination of things was ever used for any purpose quite like this.
Perhaps they would have been if they'd had your ingenuity, Doctor. Captain.
How soon will I be ready?
Right now.
Good. How long will it take the tranquilizer to have effect?
3 or 4 seconds.
How did you manage to test it?
It has not been tested.
It's not necessary, Captain. It's very simple. Nothing can go wrong.
Up to now, everything has gone wrong. I want to test it now.
Would a volunteer solve the problem?
It would.
All right. On one condition, that I'm wide awake and with you at 5 o'clock.
Guaranteed.
To kill the pain.
But this is painless.
Well, you should have warned me sooner, Mr. Spock. Fire away.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do I wonder like how much I wonder how much like research was put into the actual people and reading about them and their approach to the conflict to put into the characters. But I do think Doc Holliday stood out more to me than the Earp brothers. Maybe that's just because to me Doc Holliday is already more of like an iconic legendary figure of the Old West. But I just thought he was a more interesting character in this. In my opinion. So I think the Earp brothers kind of took a back seat.
Okay, well, as I said, I'll stick with respect to the Malkotian leader and his thoughts with respect to that. Let's move gently then into numbers. Jessica, what score would you actually give Spectre of the Gun from your own perspective?
I'd give this actually probably a 7.5. I think, yeah, on a scale from triples being 10. It's a good 7.5. I think that the Old West setting though, I think that does influence quite a lot of why I like it because I do just think it's such a fun setting. And then having them go from space to the Old West is just such an interesting jump. And I like the use of the set. I liked the music and I did like the voice of the Malkotians. My dad actually compared him to the sound, like the voice actor from the Ten Commandments movie. And I thought that was like very similar to me too. So that's interesting though, hearing that he was in the demon with the glass hand. That may be why he was so familiar. But yeah, I think very good episode. I would rewatch it.
Yeah, I think it does pay a rewatching. Again, I can appreciate the comments that have been raised about a first time around. You think, what the flip? Because it does seem to lack what a lot of Star Trek episodes used to have, and still do, of course, which is the inner story integrity. I think this one has inner story integrity, but it needs to be rewatched to kind of be appreciated from the sense of the dream escape and the fact that it does pretty much take place in the mind. And specters themselves are often things that we see as ghosts and shadows without substance and so on. Ian, what mark would you actually go for this?
I'd give it a 7, I think. It wasn't the best episode I've ever seen, but I also didn't feel like I'd wasted my time watching it. So 7 out of 10 from me.
Yeah, I'll probably sort of look to maybe even nudge it up to an 8. Victoria, presumably you're going to bring the average down substantially from this point of view, but anyway, you're perfectly entitled to do whatever you wish.
I'm going to give it a solid 3.5.
Yeah. Victoria suddenly taking over the mantle of what used to be referred to
I
as
can
the.
see Jessica's face going, what?
Yeah.
It's so like I didn't expect that. That caught me off guard. That was a plot twist.
No, because okay, if I watch it again after seeing everybody's opinions, I can appreciate them, take it into account. But the point is of the program is to watch it and enjoy it and appreciate it there and then, not to have a discussion, go back and go, oh yeah, I see what they mean.
Hardly. I mean, I think it's also a case of how does it connect with us in 2023, as you say, 142 years after the original gunfight at the OK Corral, and whether it still has a message. And I still think that that final message about overcoming our instinct for violence, and also the very
That's
specific
why it
gender
gets the
balance of
half a
this,
point extra.
in terms of mankind, how did we manage to survive? And that really is at the heart of the original series of Star Trek, that actually we do survive and thrive and travel through into the 23rd century, which sometimes, as indeed we will probably all acknowledge, seems to be less of a likelihood, but never mind. We must find out what Larry Nemechek, who sadly wasn't unable to actually join us today, Dr. Trek aficionado and indeed a Trek expert, what he makes of this particular episode. I'm sure they have one or two fascinating things to say, but worry not, because within the next 168 hours, we'll be moving from the 23rd century to the 24th century as we actually investigate and analyze an episode at which it's generally regarded this was the moment when the series actually took off and effectively started really finding its form. It's the final episode of the third season of Star Trek: The Next Generation, with, of course, Patrick Stewart in the command chair as Jean-Luc Picard. Or is he Locutus of Borg? And that might have given it away, because we'll be talking about the best of both worlds, part one, because we'll be looking after over a 2 week period. So, the best of both worlds, part one. I suspect, Victoria, in that instance, you'll be finding this a lot more full of dynamic Shakespearean acting than your experience of Spectre of the Gun, because it is obviously taking place as mankind or humanity, or the Federation, shall we say, is faced with its most formidable enemy, that of the cybernetic organisms, the Borg, who will assimilate us in all sorts of ways. So that's to come on Resonance Rewind. Finally, Victoria, as we now have tickets available for your November the 25th performance at Lincoln, at the University of Lincoln, in the Cargill Lecture Theatre. There are only, I think, just over 140 that are actually left at present, so they are going. So get them quickly. Victoria, just share with us details about that. How can people get involved with that? I know Jessica, sadly, probably won't be able to make it from North Carolina, but there are others who are based on campus who will be able to make this. So, Victoria, share with us what it is and what they can do to actually get tickets to see yourself and Chloe Rose.
Yep, me and Chloe Rose together doing solos, duets, covers. Go to Siren Radio Presents on Facebook groups, and click interested or going, get your tickets, make some comments, invite your friends. And I've just put a link on there that's to both mine and Chloe's pages on Facebook. So join us on there, follow us, and we're going to put up loads of pictures and videos and backstage things so that everybody can keep up to date.
It's an exciting opportunity. Ian, will you be there?
I will do my very best.
There you go. but for now, to Ian Barnsley, law lecturer extraordinaire. Anything to do with law, Ian is your man. Specifically, all aspects of law, really. But is there a particular branch of law that you specialise in?
Media law.
There you are, media law. To Jessica Burtis, as ever, a delight from North Carolina, and to Victoria Simmons, currently from the joys of Romsey. There we are. Huge thanks. And inevitably, given that nothing is real, as John Lennon might once have said, before we go to some more magical music from Spectre of the Gun, remember, keep on resonating.
Captain, I don't understand.
Neither do I. He's in perfect health.
What happened? Where have I been?
Right here, it seems.
But that girl, she was so beautiful. So real.
Do you remember anything else?
No.
Good. Perhaps that explains why he's here. Nothing was real to him. Except the girl.
Captain, the Melkoshian object.
Sensor readings?
The object is beginning to emit M-rays of a highly unstable nature, Captain.
Lieutenant, sound red alert. Let's check off. Deflector shields on full. Gun crews, lock on target.
Energy output increasing beyond measurable levels, Captain.
Laser guns, stand by to fire.
It's gone, sir.
Damage reported, then?
No damage, sir. All decks report fully operational.
Captain Kirk, you did not kill. Is this the way of your kind?
It is. We fight only when there's no choice. We prefer the ways of peaceful contact. I speak for a vast alliance of fellow creatures who believe in the same thing. We have sought you out to join us. Our mission is still one of peace.
Approach our planet and be welcome. A delegation will come out to meet you. Our warning threats are over.
Excellent. Lieutenant, cancel red alert. Okay. Mr. Chekhov, resume original course, warp factor 2.
Warp factor 2, sir.
Captain, may I ask a question? You needn't answer if it seems too personal.
I'm sure I'll be able to give you an answer, Mr. Spock.
This afternoon, you wanted to kill, didn't you?
But he didn't kill, Mr. Spock.
But he wanted to, Doctor.
Is that the way it seemed to you, Mr. Spock?
Yes, Captain.
Mr. Spock, you're absolutely right. That's exactly the way it was.
Mankind ready to kill.
That's the way it was in 1881.
I wonder how humanity managed to survive.
We overcame our instinct for violence.
Thank you.
If you're traveling to the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true love of mine.
See for me that her hair's hanging down. It curls and falls all down her breast. See for me that her hair's hanging down. That's the way I remember her best.
If you go when the snowflakes fall, when the rivers freeze and summer ends, please see for me if she's wearing a coat so warm to keep her from the howling.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fair,
where the winds hit heavy
on the borderline, please say hello to one who lives there. For she was once a true love of mine. In the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true love. A true love of mine.